Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books with Zivi. I'm the host, Zivi Owens. I am an author. My latest is blank, pub date March 1st, a novel. I'm also a podcaster, obviously, a publisher, a bookstore owner, and so much more. If you love books, you're in the right place. In fact, we call it the Ziviverse, or really, the LA Times called it the Ziviverse, and we're going with it. Go to ziviowens.com to learn more and follow me on Instagram at Zivi Owens. Meg Kissinger is the author of While You Were Out, an intimate family portrait of mental illness in an era of silence. Meg is a Pulitzer Prize finalist and author. She will help you see and think about people with mental illness in a new light. Her engaging memoir, While You Were Out, has been praised for its incisive reporting, boundless compassion, and surprising humor. It was named an editor's choice by the New York Times, the LA Times, Amazon, Goodreads, and Independent Booksellers Association. Audible chose it as the best of the year. Kissinger spent more than 2 decades traveling across the country to report on our nation's failed mental health system, winning dozens of national awards. She is a popular speaker at universities, civic organizations, and corporate events. Kissinger taught investigative reporting at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism and is a trainer for the school's DART Center on Trauma and Journalism. Kissinger lives in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, along the shores of Lake Michigan, her favorite place to plunge, even on the coldest day in January. Welcome, Meg. Thanks so much for coming on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books to discuss While You Were Out, an intimate family portrait of mental illness in an era of silence. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
As I was just saying, I was so happy you reached out about this book. I've now recommended this book. My colleague was reading this book. Anyway, really powerful. Why don't you tell listeners a little bit about your story and how it became
a book? Yeah, it's a Lulu. So, you know, that's always the toughest part is to get right to the meat of it because it's a stunner. I mean, there's a lot of stuff goes down in this book. So it's ostensibly a book about my family, which is I'm the fourth of 8 kids. And we came from a family that was full of love and joy, but also a lot of mental illness. And unfortunately for us, you know, we were growing up in an era and a time when we didn't talk about that. So I was born in 1957. So we were right in the heart of the baby boom. And all kinds of mayhem ensued, you know, sad things, but also rollicking, you know, fun stuff. But the point in my writing this book was to show that two things can be true. You know, you can have a family that is marred by mental illness, but it can also be a place of great love and comfort and support. And I think that's surprising. I think people wouldn't figure that both of those things can happen at once.
Well, you do a great job. The way you portray each character is with compassion and sort of multifaceted, right? Like the humor and the pain, and it's hard to pull that off. You know,
I don't. Yeah, thank you. Well, they made it a little easier because they're hilarious people, and
yeah.
So I'm lucky to come from a wacky tribe.
You have a passage, it's later in the book, but you ask this question. You say, when should a person's right to autonomy yield to their safety or the safety of others? These are not easy questions to answer, if there are any answers at all. I knew this story would be fraught with controversy, but there was no avoiding it. My job was to write about the mental health system. This is the third rail of mental health debates, so highly charged that you risk getting zapped by just touching it. It made me angry to hear gun rights advocates overstate the problem as they pushed for easier commitment laws over stricter gun measures. I was equally annoyed by mental health advocates who criticize any stories about dangerousness as reinforcing stereotypes, but it was my duty as a journalist to explore the issue.
Right.
Talk to me about that and your role as a journalist.
Right. So not surprisingly, I was a newspaper reporter for many years, 40 to be specific, but not surprisingly, many of my stories involved the mental health system and really our country's failure in providing adequate care for people who suffer with mental illness. And I came about that, of course, in the most natural of ways, because I'd seen this firsthand in my own house with my brothers and sisters and my parents. And so I'd seen how really what awful or any treatment, a lack of any treatment. So I was very curious about that. And it was a lot easier to ask strangers these very pointed questions about what it's like to have mental illness, what it's like to not be able to get relief or care from that. And so that's really my focus, especially for the last 25 years of my time as a reporter in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, was writing about just that, our nation's failure. But the toughest question of all is, how do you get people into care if they don't have insight into their own illness? And I have I agree that it used to be way too easy to lock somebody up. So, you know, it used to be on the signature of a husband or a wife or a neighbor, and you get three people and sign a petition, and boom, off they go behind a locked door, sometimes to never be seen again. And that's not right. People with mental illness have civil rights. But the flip side of that was also true, that we, in our zeal to close down all these asylums, again, many with good reason, but a lot of that was also motivated by saving money. So where do people who are very seriously ill ending up? And in no good place, you know, on the streets, in jails and prisons, they're not getting the kind of custodial or treatment and care that they need. So there's not an easy answer to that, unfortunately. And that tension is always there. And a lot of people fall through the cracks of that tension.
Wow. Well, big, interesting questions to tackle.
Right.
Can you tell listeners a little bit more about your family and the way specifically that mental illness found its way into your home?
Sure. So I'm the fourth of eight kids. There were five girls and three boys. And we were born in a lickety-split fashion, you know, so very typical, again, of the baby boom, especially in an Irish Catholic house. So my parents got married in 1952, and by 1964, they had eight kids. So that is kind of staggering. It was actually a really funny scene in the beginning of the book where my mom, you know, the pill comes out, and she's so excited. And she goes to, but then the Pope says, you can't take birth control. And my mother's like, can I say shit on the podcast? Well, whatever. She says a naughty word and finds her way to the confessional to seek a dispensation. Anyway, she had a lot of kids, and she was really in no...
No, but then she got everyone in the town to line up, right?
Well, that's the punchline. The punchline of the whole thing is that she does finally finagle this dispensation from the priest, this young associate. And she, you know, says very plaintively, you know, I've done enough to propagate the faith, Father. Anyway, he gives her the dispensation. And the next Saturday, the phone rings and it's Father Welsh. And he wants to speak to my mother. And he doesn't sound too happy. I answered the phone just by happenstance. Anyway, my mother gets on the horn and he says to her, Jean, what goes on in the confessional is private both ways, because that day, the next Saturday, the line for his confessional was around the block. And my mother has, you know, spilled the beans to all of her friends who were equally as desperate to go on the pill. Anyway, she, you know, bless her heart, she was a loving, wonderful, soulful, bright woman, but she really had no business having 8 kids in 12 years. And she didn't have the resources for it. I mean, happily, we had the financial wherewithal. My dad had a good job, but she had no mother. She had no sisters. She had baseline anxiety and depression. Again, words that we didn't speak in those days because we didn't talk like that. We didn't identify. People didn't speak like that back in those days. Anyway, I come downstairs for breakfast one morning. I'm 6 years old, looking for my mom and a bowl of cream of wheat, and she's nowhere to be found. And nobody will tell me where the heck she is. So I later learned, many years later, she was hospitalized, you know, for what was probably postpartum depression. But again, these were words that we didn't speak. And so I remember my father's mother, my crazy Irish grandmother, telling me, you know, I said, well, what'll I tell the nuns at school? I was trying to figure out where my mother was. And she said, just tell them she's got pneumonia. Tell the nuns she's got pneumonia. So that was the first time I really realized, whew, something screwy is going on here. You know, there's something not right in our house. And then one by one, you know, people, brothers and sisters of mine, began to present with their own forms of mental illness, some very severe. And, you know, I'm not ruining any secrets to tell you that two of the 8 kids ended up dying by suicide. So, you know, it took a great toll on our family. And, you know, all of us suffered in one way or another. And so that's, you know, again, it sounds like such a grim story, but our family is one that has remarkably stayed together. And, you know, we're there for each other now in ways that I don't see too often. And so that was the story I wanted to tell, was a story of resilience, you know, not in a cheesy way. I mean, we still all are banged up, but how do you move forward when you're so saddled with all these illnesses?
Well, I am so sorry for the losses in your family and what the consequences of all of that. So thank you for sharing it with everybody else.
Oh, sure. Thank you. You know, Zibby, so many people live with this. It's just, it's remarkable. This book came out in September, and I probably get, without exaggeration, 4 or 5 emails or forms of communication, you know, Instagram, Facebook, whatever. The only thing I haven't gotten is like smoke signals or pigeons. I'll probably get those like next week. But anyway, I get, you know, people are reaching out to say, I thought you were writing about my family. You know, this is so prevalent. And unfortunately, so is suicide. So we need to start talking about this in much more candid ways and much clearer ways. And that's what this book is meant to do, is to kind of bear witness and to offer people a chance to tell their story too.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a close friend die by suicide in high school. Well, she was my good friend from high school, but it didn't happen until we were out of college. But I think about it all the time. Like, where could I have, not that it was up to me, of course, I'm just one small player in all of the characters, but what could any of us done differently? Like, I'm still in touch with her mom regularly, and I don't know, where would she be now? And, you know, it's very hard not to go down that path.
It's such a heartache. You know, I see my brother and sister's friends all the time. Well, for this book, I reached out to them. You know, I wanted to really remember them. My sister died many years ago, in 1978. That's a long time ago. And then my brother Danny died in 1997. But, you know, I had to conjure them. I had to like bring them back to life on the page. And that was tough to do. So I really, because, you know, your inclination, it's so sad, you just kind of sweep it out of your mind as best you can. But then that's too bad too, because you love them and you want to hold them close and remember them. So it's really tough. You know, I think a death by suicide is especially tough to kind of, you know, hold that person with you still. And so I will run into, you know, their old buddies, their old running mates. And I reached out for the purposes of this book. I even found some of my sister's old high school boyfriends that we used to call, one of them was the hugger and the other was the kisser. So I found the hugger and the kisser, and they told me stories about my sister in the car and the Camaro at the lakefront. And they were like, whoa, stop there. We don't need to know. We don't need to go into all these details. But it was really fun. It was fun to kind of be back with them again, but sad too, you know, because it's, you wonder, what could I have done? And, you know, I think especially in the case of my sister, Nancy, I was 4 years younger than she, and we used to scrap, you know, we used to fight, and I would steal her clothes, and I was like the bratty little sister. So you feel not a small measure of guilt, and I'm not the one that caused her to take her own life. I know that, but it's just kind of a natural question.
Well, how did it feel for you to turn your sort of journalistic eye on something so personal and on your family? Like, was that a challenge? Was it, what did it feel like?
Yeah, it was very intense. So, and I knew it would be, and I kind of wanted it to be in a way because, you know, again, by never talking about these, especially Nancy's death, it just got pushed down and pushed to the side. So just a little orientation. The night that Nancy died, in June of 1978, my father called us all into the living room. And he said, you know, in no uncertain terms, if anybody asks, this was an accident. And the reason he said that was that he was afraid that we would not be able to have a funeral mass, you know, a Catholic service for Nancy, and she wouldn't be able to be buried in the Catholic cemetery plot because the Catholic Church has had a very awful draconian view of suicide in which they vilify the person who died and consider them to be, you know, a mortal sinner separated from God. So anyway, that was not an unnatural fear on my dad's part. But what it did for us as kids was to scare the hell out of us, you know, and it made us feel very ashamed. So the shame of her death led us, you know, scattered into corners, not talking about it. And nothing good comes of unresolved grief. So, you know, down the road, as we all are beginning to present with our own forms of mental illness, and especially my younger brother, Danny, you know, again, not having a way to talk about it or never having really resolved it or gone through any kind of group therapy, just unbelievable to me that we would never really sit down as a family and discuss the suicide death of our sister. But that kind of set the table or, you know, or laid the groundwork for, I think, you know, what happened then to my brother Danny and how he didn't have the coping skills. So the journalist in me, you know, the person that spent 25 years writing about the crappy mental health system, wanted to turn the reporter's notebook, you know, back on our family and slow walk people through and say, how did this all happen? And what lessons can we learn? You know, in the same way that we do for the George Floyd beating, you know, the beating death of him, the 9/11, any kind of tragedy or calamity, you go back and reverse engineer, you know, as we call it in investigative reporting, we reverse engineer. So that's what I wanted to do. So I knew I had to go and get the police records, get the medical files, do all these interviews, really do the diligence and the kind of building of a story in the same way that I did with my investigations for the newspaper. And so in order to do that, I really wanted to get buy-in from my surviving siblings, you know, because it's their family too, mm-hmm. and it's their tragedy. And so just lucky for me, they're wonderful people. And so I, you know, had my fingers crossed when I went to them and said, you know, what do you think? Should we do this? I want to do this story about our family, but I don't want to ruin my relationship with you. I'm not willing to throw you under the bus for the sake of me writing this book. So happily for me, they all signed on.
Wow.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp.
Sometimes we all have stuff we need to get off our chests. Even if we don't think it's interfering with our daily life, there are some things you just haven't processed, be it grief or trauma, eating disorders, anything. It might be time to work on those things, and I have a solution for you. Therapy. Online therapy by BetterHelp. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. I took the brief questionnaire online where there were, 20 questions. It didn't take long at all, maybe 3 minutes. And then I got matched with a therapist who could help me work on whatever. I picked trauma because even though it happened in 2001, I am somehow still not over the loss of my friend on 9/11. And it is what it is. BetterHelp is going to help. And I am so excited, especially because with my special code, instead of $80 a month, it is 10% off, $72 a month, which is so much less than traditional therapy. And you'll get a perfect therapist for you. There are 35,000 therapists to choose from, so you'll find the right one. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/momsdonthavetime today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/momsdonthavetime.
Well, aside from people sharing some of their own experiences, what have been some of the main benefits you've gotten from doing this project?
Woo! Well, I know you're not supposed to write a book as therapy because just go to a damn therapist, which I finally did, at the tender age of 64. I found a good butt in a chair. Can you even believe that, Zippy? I mean, really, that's ridiculous.
No.
Oh my God, I was too scared. I did go one time, as I recall in the book. I was in my 40s. My best friend said to me, you have to go see somebody. Anyway, I did. And then I got so scared when she said, well, tell me about your family. And as I started to tell her, she was like, her eyes got bigger and bigger. And I thought she was going to like reach for the button under the desk and the guys would come in with a big net and take me off. Anyway, I never went. And she said, let's have you come back, every week, like for the rest of your life. And I lied to her. I'm like, let me go home and get with my calendar. Anyway, I never called her back. I was too scared. But then when I was putting this book together, I thought, okay, now we're getting down and dirty. Like I need some scaffolding here. I need help from a professional. So I do have a therapist, so I don't need to write a book in order to exercise my therapy, but it did help. I have to say. And, I think it not only helped me, but it helped my siblings too. It helped my brothers and sisters to give a narrative arc or a shape to the chaos of growing up in a family with so much mental illness in a time when that wasn't discussed. And it was just a big blob. But now here it is, concrete on the page. There's a time frame that kind of makes sense. So in that way, it was very liberating. And another benefit, this is something that I worried about as I was starting to write this book. I kind of made my mother, I glorified her. She died young. And I think when people die young, you tend to, make them a little bit more of a saint. My dad always said, the halo goes on tighter. Anyway, I was worried that I was going to draw my mom as a one-dimensional character, as like saintly. And I learned through the course of writing this book, she was far from a saint. She'd made some big time mistakes. And one that took me, I had to drink many bottles of sangria and lie in a hammock for a long, long time to process. So I learned some stuff about my mother in the course of writing this book that really rattled me. And the halo came flying off. But at the end, when I'm wrapping it all up, I really come to this much deeper and fuller understanding of her in a much more mature and, as I said, fuller way. And at the end of the day, I ended up loving her even more. So that was great.
I was good to get the skeletons out, right? Learn the whole story. Parents, people. Well, I'm sure your therapist appreciated the massive head start you got on the work with the books.
Yeah, she was very helpful for me.
Do you have plans for more books, or where are you going with your journalism and all of that? What's coming next for you?
Well, this one kicked my butt. Yeah, I am getting so many calls and people reaching out wanting to talk about the book, which is fantastic. You know, this is exactly why I wrote it. So, and I am saying no to nobody. I mean, if your dog has a book group and wants to come, I will come and talk to that dog. I wrote it to talk about it. So I've got a big old bag of throat lozenges and lots of tea with honey. And I'm just out and about all the time talking about this book. I don't know if I have another book in me. I only have one family. I mean, I have kids of my own and now grandkids, but they can write their own memoir about me, but I do want them to wait until I'm dead. But I have no, you know, immediate plans. But, you know, never say never, because who knows? Yeah.
Is there anything in particular that writing the book made you miss even more about your siblings?
Yeah. So my sister Nancy was, I mean, they were both hilarious, really funny people. And you know, when they were good, they were very good. So I missed, you know, hanging out with her. I really came to realize what a little shit I was as a sister to her in our high school days. You know, well, I was 4 years younger, so we were never in high school at the same time. But, you know, when I was stealing her clothes and stuff. And I wish that I'd had the opportunity to let her know that I'm so sorry that she was suffering. You know, like, I just thought she was a pain in the neck, which she was. But she was also suffering. So, you know, I wish that the old lady version of me wishes that I could tell her. That's why I hope there's a heaven. There's probably not a heaven, although, you know, I hope there is. But anyway, whatever's next, if I get to see her again, I do want to say, I'm sorry that I stole your sweaters. You were a good person and I love you, you know, and ditto for my brother, Danny. I'm sorry that we didn't protect you better. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the book allowed me the opportunity to frame those thoughts.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. And judging from, you know, comments that I'm getting from readers, they're identifying with that a lot, even if they, especially those who have had people die by suicide in their family, but just living with people with mental illness, which is not easy. That, I don't mean to soft pedal, like, it is a burden to live with depression or anxiety or whatever form of serious mental illness you have. And that's why we really need to love those people a lot more. So the week before my brother Danny died, he wrote me a letter talking about how he did have mental illness. It was something that he had never admitted to previously. And so this was a confession of sorts for him. And he said it caused him to do and say awkward things. And he ended the letter by saying, you know, love and understanding is what we need to conquer this. And it sounded so cheesy to me at the time, but after he died, you know, I saw that he was right, that that's what we need to do. We need to love people who suffer from mental illness and try and understand them as best we can. So that's my mantra. And that's what I think this book helps people to do.
Amazing. Meg, thank you so much. Thanks for coming on, for talking about your book, for sharing your family secrets, if you will, and all the things that make your family who it was and that make you all the vehicle for helping so many others.
Wonderful, Sibby. Thank you. Thanks for all you do. You are wonderful.
Thank you. All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens and at Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Also, sign up for my newsletter at ZibbyOwens.com and sign up for my virtual book club and meet lots of authors on Zoom every other week. Thanks so much to Steve and Ryan at Texture Sound for the sound editing. And thank you to Morning Moon Productions for providing this fantastic intro and outro music.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.